This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Good evening. This is Gary Clinton, and I'd like to welcome you to Night Transmissions. This is episode number 46. First up tonight is an episode of CBS Mystery Theater, The Lady Was a Tiger, which was first aired on February the 5th of 1974. This is one of the earlier efforts of CBS Mystery Theater, which was an ambitious effort by veteran radio producer Hyman Brown to revive interest in American radio drama. It was reasonably successful. Every night from 1974 to 1982, host E.G. Marshall and then later Tammy Grimes would take you through a creaking door for an hour of fear you can hear. This program ran daily, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year, to produce nearly 200 episodes of Mystery Theater every year. They used both original stories and adaptations of classic stories by the likes of Edgar Allan Poe, Mark Twain, Robert Louis Stevenson, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. You get the idea, people like that. The cast was often veterans from radio's golden age, Agnes Moorehead, Richard Widmark, Celeste Holm, Mercedes McCambridge, Howard DeSilva. Again, you get the idea. There were many up-and-coming stage and film actors included. People like Tony Roberts, Morgan Fairchild, Mandy Patinkin, and Sarah Jessica Parker were on it. In any case, during the 8 years the show ran on CBS, it produced almost 1,400 shows. In tonight's show, a young newspaper reporter who is sort of unaccountably down on his luck through some rather odd circumstances finds himself headed for Paris, France on the trail of Nazi treasure. Soon, he himself is pursued by spies and the police, and of course, a beautiful young woman.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents... I'm E.G. Marshall. Welcome to the fear you can hear. Welcome to the world of your own terrifying imagination. The art of the double cross, unfortunately, has become part of the fabric of our lives. In espionage, however, it is almost a lifestyle. In the world of spies, for the left hand ever to know what the right is doing is unthinkable. For the next hour, imagine that you are Larry Fielding, a 32-year-old newspaper man caught in a dizzying web of circumstances seemingly beyond his control.
Larry, please change your mind and come with me.
Not until you tell me who you are and why you sneaked into my hotel room.
You're a fool, Larry. You must know that the police are looking for you and they'll be here any minute.
Oh, well, you're here now. And I still want to know who you are.
If that's so important, my name is Carol Johnson. And when I tell you I know all about the murder of Dave Wilson, maybe you'll believe that I'm here to help you.
Our mystery drama, The Lady Was a Tiger, written especially for the Mystery Theater by Murray Burnett, stars William Redfield. It is sponsored in part by Anheuser-Busch Incorporated, Brewers of Budweiser, and by the Kellogg Company, makers of Kellogg's Special K cereal. I'll be back shortly with Act One.
Hi, I'm Goldilocks, Ms. Goldilocks, if you please. And I'm a professional taste tester. Here at my taste test laboratory, that's TTL for short, I taste test everything from porridge to diet drinks. Actually, there's not that much taste testing in porridge these days. There used to be. Once upon a time, I mean, that's how this Miz got into the biz. But lately, it's been diet drinks. I mean, with so many diet drinks going sugar-free, I've been really busy conducting taste tests. A rather unbearable assignment, to be sure. But then I discovered sugar-free diet 7-Up. Fresh, natural, delicious. My only problem is that sugar-free diet 7-Up tastes so good that it broke my Goldilocks diet drink taste-o-meter. Well, sugar-free diet 7-Up certainly has my seal of approval. This one's just right.
Don't let anyone con you into thinking it's wrong to turn in a heroin pusher. You're not ratting. You're doing your part to wipe out one of the most insidious epidemics racking our country today. So don't let anyone kid you. If you really care about the quality of life, if you really care about improving society, you'll do everything you can to get the heroin pusher off the street and into jail where he belongs. If you have information about a drug pusher, use the heroin hotline. The number is 800-368-5363. That's toll free from anywhere in the country. The number again is 800-368-5363. A trained operator will answer your call, take your information, and pass it on to experienced federal agents who will investigate. You'll make your own special contribution toward helping us wipe out what President Nixon has called public enemy number one. Call 800-368-5363.
Walking is great exercise, and with good weather can also be great fun. But not when you've just been fired by the editor of the newspaper for which you've worked happily for 5 years. Larry Fielding has been walking aimlessly for 2 hours, trying to figure out why Horace Finley, the editor and his boss, had refused to give him any reason for his dismissal. Tormented by his frustrating thoughts and tired, Larry sits down on a park bench to think. He is so deep in thought, he is unaware of three men who suddenly surround him. Larry has only to look at them to know that he is in trouble. He tries to get up, but is pushed back down, and the men start to beat him up.
No, take my money and leave me alone, will you? Look, if you want money, I told you, you can have it. Help! Help!
Calling for help when you're being mugged in a big city park is sometimes as helpful as trying to catch hold of a windowsill in a 30-story fall. But this time, there was a miracle. A stranger has seen the attack and rushes to help.
Hey, in there, man! Here comes... That's a nice jaw you have there, fella. You need a lesson in chicken.
That took care of them. They're gone.
Oh, thanks.
Let me help you up.
Thanks, mister. Thanks a lot. I tell you, I was in real trouble.
My pleasure. Did they get your wallet?
No. I got a lot of bruises, but they didn't get a thing. Say, you're a pretty good scrapper for a...
For a guy my age?
Well, yeah. Hey, what are you, a karate expert?
Oh, just keep myself in shape.
You sure do. Listen, can I do something for you to show you I really meant thanks?
You certainly can. How about coffee?
Oh, sure, but that's nothing. What I meant was...
I know what you meant. My name's Dave Wilson.
Oh, good. I'm Larry Fielding.
Oh, come on, Larry. Let's have a cup of coffee.
You know, I still can't get over the way you tore into those guys.
I was a commando in World War II.
World War II?
Did you think I was in the Civil War?
No, I didn't mean that. It's just...
Well, to a young fellow like you, World War II might as well have been in the last century. It was only 30-some-odd years ago, you know.
Oh, I know. After all, I was in the newspaper business.
Yeah, that stuff which you told me about losing your job. What are you going to do?
Oh, I don't know. Look around for another one. What bothers me is the way my editor let me go. No explanations. You know, we were friends. You'd think he'd at least tell me why he fired me.
Those things happen. Stop torturing yourself and begin making plans.
No, not until I get this thing straightened out in my own mind. I think I'll call my editor to home tonight and...
I've got a better idea.
Go out and get drunk, huh?
Nope. How about a trip to Paris?
Are you putting me on?
I'm serious.
Well, what are you? A scout for contestants for some kind of TV quiz show?
No, I am a man sitting on a couple of $100,000.
What?
And I need a guy just like you.
Now, look, I'm a newspaper man. Anytime a stranger starts talking about a trip to Paris and a couple of $100,000,
Walk away without even listening?
Yeah.
Even if the man just happened to maybe save you from being mugged, robbed, and beaten up?
Okay, all right, I'll listen, but believe me, that'll be it.
Fair enough. First, here's my card.
Oh, David Wilson Calridge Imports. I never heard of him.
You can call and check me out. I told you I was in World War II.
Oh, look, I'm grateful to you, but you're wasting your time.
Why don't you shut up and listen? You've probably heard about the millions of dollars in artworks and precious jewels that the GIs liberated during the last days of the war.
Liberated, sure, yeah. Well, I've heard stories.
Well, most of them are true. One that I know in particular certainly is... Did you ever hear of the Lancerre collection?
Lancerre.
Comte de Lancerre came from an old French family. And the Lancerre collection is a fabulous assortment of diamonds, rubies, emeralds, and other precious stones, which were seized by the Nazis when they swept through France in 1940. A pal of mine, not a commando, happened to come upon the collection when the Americans were driving the Germans back in 44.
Wait a minute. And he... liberated it?
Exactly. He and a distinguished Frenchman named Henri Thiel.
What? Professor Henri Thiel? The archaeologist?
That's the man.
Oh, come on. He wouldn't...
You were saying something?
No, nothing.
You were about to say he wouldn't get involved in anything crooked, weren't you?
Yeah, something like that.
You're right, he wouldn't. But he was younger. The world was quite different then. And my G.I. pal was a most persuasive guy. They decided to bury the Lancerre collection. They did. They drew a map. And today, Professor Thiel is the only possessor of that map.
Uh-huh. And what happened to your nameless friend?
He's dead. Professor Thiel wants to return the jewels.
But that's easy, isn't it?
Not if the professor doesn't want embarrassing questions asked about how he came by that app in the first place.
Oh. What about you?
Calridge Imports is a highly respected and reputable importing firm. I want to keep it that way.
Oh, so do I, even though I've just been fired.
You haven't heard what I'm asking you to do.
Well, what?
Come with me to Paris. You're writing a story on Professor Thiel. He's good material. You'll grant me that.
Yes.
You'll interview him, naturally. During the course of that interview, he'll give you a slip of paper, which is a map showing the location of the jewels. You'll later deliver it to me. And that's all you have to do.
You, mentioned something about sitting on hundreds of thousands of dollars?
That's right. The Lancer collection is worth that and more. I'm sitting on it. I intend to return the jewels and collect a reward. If you want to share in that, you deserve it. Mrs. Wilson, the report is positive. Fielding has agreed to go to Paris with me. He bought the story about picking up a map showing the location of the Lancerre collection. Operation successful. You'd better be on your way, Larry. You're due at Professor Thiel's in 10 minutes.
I suppose it's too late to back out, huh?
You can always back out, Larry, but I don't think you will. was really nothing to it. Make it look like a normal interview, take notes. The professor will give you the map, slip it in with your notes. Bring it back to me here. I'll be waiting.
Okay.
Larry.
Yes?
Relax.
Oh, sure thing. I'll see you.
Would Monsieur mind if I joined him?
I wouldn't mind at all, but I don't think I'm what you're looking for.
Oh, but Monsieur is exactly what I seek. Exactly.
And just what is it you're seeking?
To warn you that you are in grave danger.
Why don't you come off it with that phony accent? If you've got something to say to me, say it.
Would Monsieur buy me a Pernod?
Sure. Garçon, Pernod, please.
Monsieur, it is very difficult for me. I do play a role, as you have guessed. And I am not here by chance. You must leave, and quickly.
Your Pernod, monsieur.
Not for me, it's for the lady.
And for you, I have a knife.
Go. But he's going to die.
Do as I say. There'll be no problem. Simply put his head down gently on the table. So, and people will see another drunken tourist.
Your name is Larry Fielding. You are 28 years old, and you're feeling marvelous. You have just completed a fascinating interview with Professor Henry Teal. And you have the paper that you're going to hand over to your friend who's waiting at Les Deux Magots. You see him at the table where you left him. His head is down, but you're not concerned.
Dave, wake up. I saw the professor. What?
Monsieur, what has happened?
Well, I don't know. I came back to meet my friend. I guess he's passed out.
A moment, monsieur. Look, this man has been murdered.
What?
Stabbed to death. You will wait here for the police.
I will. I will not. I'm getting out of here.
Who is there?
It is I. Open up.
What's the matter? What happened?
The other American. The young one. He got away.
You let him go?
He panicked. Ran.
Now what?
He'll probably go back to his room at the Dauphine. You'll check.
But aren't the police looking for him?
I hope so. I gave them a complete description.
And what do I say to them if they find me in his room?
Come, a beautiful young lady like yourself. Get to him and find out where the paper is.
Promise not to scream. Right. Okay. Now, why have you picked the lock into my room?
Never mind. You have to get out of here.
Not until you tell me who you are.
If that matters, my name is Carol Johnson. I've been sent here to help you.
Oh, sure.
I know about the murder of your friend.
Wait a minute. Sent by whom?
I'll answer your questions while we're on the way.
On the way to where?
Safety.
I don't need to run. I didn't kill anybody. I'm not about to take off with a strange girl, particularly not one who's equipped with skeleton keys.
Oh, suit yourself. Goodbye.
Come in.
Monsieur de Rance-Fielding.
Yes?
Inspector Victor Roux, Sûreté.
Oh.
You will please come with me.
What for?
Suspicion of murder of another American? Monsieur David Wilson.
Inspector, listen. Why would I kill Dave? I've already told you I had an appointment to meet Dave at the cafe. He was waiting for me. Would I have walked up to a man I just killed and shake him so that he'd fall down and make a big scene?
That is your explanation. There is nothing to support it.
Yes, well, there's nothing against it either.
There is the word of Louis Goret.
Who's he?
The waiter who attended the table at which Monsieur Wilson and you sat. The only reason that you are not, as of this moment, charged with murder is because you did return. That much the waiter's testimony supports. Only he says that Monsieur Wilson might very well have been dead shortly after you returned, and that you had time to kill him.
That's a lie.
So you say?
Oh, just check with Professor Teal. He'll tell you what time I arrived, what time I left.
We have been trying. And there has been no answer. Ah, we may have him on the telephone now. Hello? Eh? Ah? So? Very bien. Merci.
All right, well, what did he say?
That was not Professor Teal. That was his apartment. And his servant.
His servant? There was nobody there when I saw him.
Don't you mean if you saw him, monsieur?
Oh.
According to the servant, Professor Teal left for an extended holiday early this morning. And it is not known when he is expected back.
I don't think it's smart to have me come here so often.
I would not have sent for you if it were not necessary. Do you still believe that Fielding knows nothing about the operation?
I do.
Then where's the document?
Well, we don't know he ever had it, do we?
We know he visited Teal. We know that Wilson waited for him at Les Dumagos. We know he came back there. I think it is safe to assume that he was carrying the plans.
And he didn't have it on him when he was arrested.
Roger arranged to be there when Fielding was brought in and searched. He says there was nothing on him.
But he wasn't picked up right away.
Exactly. He eventually went back to his hotel room, as you know. I believe he has the paper and that he has somehow managed to hide it.
Oh.
It does us no good in prison. We shall have to arrange to have him released.
And how do we do that?
We don't. You do.
Sit down, mademoiselle. Your passport says Carol Johnson.
That's right, Inspector.
And I am told you are in my office because of the unfortunate incident in the Café Les Deux Magots.
Yes, Inspector. I just had to come here to tell you you have the wrong man.
Ah? And how do you know that?
I'm studying at the Sorbonne. I visit Les Deux Magots all the time. I was sitting right there when that man was murdered.
Formidable. You saw a man murdered and you did nothing.
Oh, at the time I didn't know it was a murder. I just thought the man had too much to drink or was ill. But the reason I know that you've arrested the wrong man is that the murdered man was dead before this young American Fields
Fielding.
Yes, well, the man was dead before Fielding ever got to the table. Fielding came and shook him. And that was when it was discovered that he was dead. I'm prepared to swear to that, Inspector.
Of course you are prepared to swear to this story that you have just told me.
Why not? It's the truth.
Of course, mademoiselle. Why would a beautiful young lady like yourself lie to an inspector of the Sûreté?
I'm not sure that I like the way you say that, Inspector. But everything will be all right if you release young Fielding.
You have told me you will swear to this statement of yours in court. Therefore, I have very little choice.
Ah, good.
But, mademoiselle, I have been a police officer for 20 years, long enough to know that witnesses who appear late with an alibi for an accused murderer often have reason.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
And I also wish to warn you, mademoiselle, that the Sûreté considers this a very much open case.
That is the business of the Sûreté. Au revoir, Inspector.
Gérard, you will follow the young lady who just left my office, and do not lose her.
Hello there.
Oh, it's you.
Want to give me a lift?
Well, I suppose I owe you something for getting me out of jail. Taxi! Taxi! There, we got one. Hop in.
Oh, thanks.
Driver, Hotel Dauphine.
Well, you look pretty good for a jailbird.
You look pretty good yourself for... Come to think of it, what are you?
An American girl in Paris trying to make a living. What are you?
An American in Paris in need of a bath, a drink, and some food.
You know... You're not bad looking.
Oh, thanks.
While we seem to be exchanging compliments, can I say you're about the best-looking girl I've seen since I've been here?
Thank you. Now that we like each other so much, don't you think it's time we started telling each other the truth?
Yes, I'll buy that.
Écoutez-moi, operateur, well, never... You speak English. Okay, well, look, I phoned the desk about an hour ago to get this room straightened up, and so far nothing's happened. Now, can you please just send someone up so I can sleep here tonight, huh?
Oh, while you're at it, where's our food?
Wait a minute, that's a different department.
Oh.
I'll have to call room service again.
Oh, maybe you won't have to bother.
Entrée.
Your dinner, monsieur. Madame.
Merci.
Monsieur would like me to serve.
No, no, thanks. No, I think I can handle it myself.
As monsieur wishes.
Wait a minute. Don't I know you?
I think not, monsieur.
Now, we are. I've seen you before. I'm sure I've seen you.
Paris is a large city, monsieur. One passes people on the streets and...
This is the streets. The streets, that's it. You're the same guy who was at the Café Le Dumagot.
Monsieur is mistaken.
What? Hey, wait a minute. Come back here. I want to talk to you.
Oh, now don't go chasing him down the hall.
Why not? Listen, Carol, I'm positive he's the same waiter...
You just deny it and you can't prove it.
But...
Even if you could, what do you think it means?
Well, it means... Well, I don't know. But if I could get him to talk, maybe I'd find out something.
I thought you were going to clue me in.
Oh, yeah. Listen, have you ever heard of the Lancerre collection?
Of course. It's in the Louvre.
Oh.
The family of Comte de Lancerre gave it to the museum after it was recovered when the Nazis fled Paris.
What?
Well, why does that shake you up so much?
Because it can't be true.
Come with me to the Louvre and I'll show it to you.
Well, that changes everything. Come on.
Where are we going?
To the American consul.
Well?
Unbelievable.
What?
Simply unbelievable. Do you know what the consul told me?
I predicted it, didn't I?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to hear about it at all. Just advised me to fork up the whole thing and leave France. Incredible.
Well, not really when you understand that he doesn't know what you're talking about.
But you do.
Some of it.
Okay, take me back to the hotel.
Any reason?
I'm taking the consul's advice. If nobody's interested, I'll go back to the States.
Well, now that they've cleaned up the room so nicely, you're leaving.
Well, do you have a better idea?
More than one?
I think I'll take them one at a time.
Number one. Give me the paper Professor Teal gave you.
Well, it looks like we're finally going to level.
Where is it?
Well, first you tell me something. What is it?
I don't know.
End of conversation.
Larry, listen to me. I work for Colonel Blake, military intelligence. I was assigned to this operation.
What operation?
All I was told was that Dave Wilson, who also works for us, was coming over here with you, and that you were to get something from Professor Teal and give it to Dave.
Teal worked with you, too?
He did. But now his cover is blown, and I don't know where he is.
Who killed Wilson?
I don't know. It could have been any one of three or four foreign powers.
And the only reason I'm alive is because somebody wants the paper.
That's right.
And if I give it to you, then there's really no reason not to kill me.
Oh, give it to me. I'll get it to Colonel Blake, and we'll get you safely out of the country.
No, hold on. I got a better idea. I'll go with you to Colonel Blake, and we'll give it to him together.
No, that would be too dangerous.
To whom?
Will you please trust me?
Give me a reason.
Please, where is the paper?
I burned it.
You expect me to believe that?
Why not? You expect me to believe everything you tell me?
You admit you had the paper. And somehow, between the time you ran from Les Deux Margaux, you managed to hide it in a place where experts have been unable to find it.
I told you I burned it.
And you know that's a fairy tale that no one will believe.
I don't care whether you believe it or not. Now, are you coming with me?
Where?
To talk to your Colonel Blake.
He won't see you.
Oh, I think he will. Goodbye, Carol. It was nice knowing you. I think...
You will kindly step back into your room, Monsieur Feeling.
Now, wait a minute.
Move. Let me introduce myself. I am Major Simonovich.
Oh, Of the gay PayU or the NKVD?
It does not really matter. What matters is that you and I have something to discuss.
I warned you.
Yeah, sure you did.
We'll be back shortly.
Oh, okay. We're going to take a quick break here now. But we'll be back real soon.
Does.
I do so dislike dealing with amateurs. This is strictly a business.
You mean you want to make a deal with me?
Correction. I mean you would find it wise if you wanted to make a deal with us.
For the paper?
Exactly. Where is it?
No, not so fast, not so fast. You spoke about a deal?
You give us the paper, we give you your life.
You must really believe I'm an idiot. You people murdered Wilson. That paper is the only thing that's keeping me alive.
You have my word.
No deal.
You really believe you have a choice? Carol, call Rodzinski. Make the usual arrangements. We will wait here.
Donnez-moi 80-36, s'il vous plaît. C'est ça. Merci.
Carol.
Yes.
Tell me something. Will I like Rodzinski?
By this time, Larry Fielding realizes that he's been used. That he was never supposed to bring Dave Wilson a paper telling the location of the Lancer jewel collection. But his discoveries have only added to his dilemma. He was quick-witted enough to realize that his only hope was to hide the paper, because that slip of paper is his last resort.
Rodzinski is a doctor and a chemist. He'll be here shortly. You'll be put to sleep painlessly. You'll be taken from here in an ambulance to a safe place. And there you'll be injected with sodium pentothal, Fielding. You will tell us.
Look, I don't suppose you'll tell me what's so important about this piece of paper?
You have heard of the SAM-6 missiles. The surface-to-air weapons with deadly accuracy that we have developed and which were used so successfully in minor wars in Asia and the Middle East?
Yes, I've heard of them.
Good. We learned that someone whose identity we still seek has invented a jamming device which would render the SAM-6 almost worthless.
Ah.
We don't believe that any such system can be invented, but we do not take chances. We have reason to believe that the piece of paper that you carried away from Professor Teal's has the information for building such a device. Ah, that will be Rodzinski. Carol, admit him.
Of course. Come in, Doctor. This is the patient.
Now, look, I really don't think this is necessary.
The injection will be easier if you don't fuss, young man.
I don't intend to make...
Hold it! Now, his arm. Hold it still.
Good. You brought a stretcher?
Of course. There. You'll be under in a moment, so we can leave.
Gendarmes! It has nothing to do with us. We are taking a sick man to the hospital. Put this stretcher into the ambulance. Quickly!
I must apologize, but we received a report from the hotel concierge that there was a dead man here.
Absurd, Inspector. This is Dr. Rodzinski. The doctor will explain this to you, Inspector.
This man became suddenly quite ill. I gave him a sedative to quiet him, and we're now taking him to the Lefebvre nursing home. As you can see by the ambulance.
You say he is alive?
Very much so. See for yourself.
Ah, mon Dieu. I know this man.
Inspector, he must receive medical attention.
Of course. But I suggest that instead of taking him to the nursing home, he go instead to the police hospital.
Well, that's ridiculous. He's my patient.
I am afraid I must insist. This young man has most recently been released from jail, where we were holding him on a charge of murder.
If he has been released, then
released,
why?
Yes. But he has not been completely cleared, so... Laurent, Bigon, Take this man to the police hospital. Did you get a report?
Yes.
And?
He'll be conscious in an hour.
And he will talk.
I'm sure of that.
He will scream to see Colonel Blake, and then your cover is blown, and the whole operation goes phooey.
What do we do?
Silence him.
But what about the papers?
We will be faulted for that, of course. But if we do not have it, neither do the Americans. Who do we have in the police hospital?
Only Leclerc.
A weakling. But he can admit Rozhansky.
Rozhansky's a doctor. He doesn't need Leclerc to admit him. He can visit his patient openly.
Thank you, my dear. I visit Fielding and he dies shortly thereafter. That idea does not appeal to me.
We have to do something.
You are both right. Carol, you will be his first visitor when he regains consciousness.
No.
Yes, Carol. Rozhansky, give her your hypodermic kit.
I don't have to do this and I won't.
You would prefer that in my report I mention your failure with Fielding when you had some hours alone with him?
I'll go.
That is wise. Rozhansky, give her the syringe.
Here.
Quickly. The car is waiting. And Carol, if you should decide or even think about changing sides, it would be most unwise. You know the French police are still most interested in the person who murdered Wilson.
You awake now, Larry?
Oh, no.
Wake up and listen to me, Larry.
What?
You've got to listen. Try to understand me.
Wait a minute. What kind of a place is this?
You're safe. It's a police hospital.
Yeah, but how did you get in here? What's Rozhansky?
Look, I can understand how you feel and why you don't trust me, but the truth really is that I am a double agent.
Oh.
Do you understand what a double agent is?
As near as I can figure out, a double agent is somebody working for two different sides.
Yes.
And neither side trusts them.
Oh.
You know, that fits you to a T. You might just be telling the truth.
I am. I really work for Colonel Blake, as I told you. The Russians know it. They think I've infiltrated the U.S. military intelligence. But in
fact... Yes, I know. You've really done just the opposite.
Yes.
Worked your way into the Russian apparatus.
Exactly. Oh, Larry, how can I make you believe me?
You can't.
Listen, you were deliberately recruited. The reason you lost your job was because we got in touch with your boss. He agreed to go along. The men who jumped you were part of the setup so that Wilson could save you.
Hey, now, wait a minute. But that doesn't prove a thing. You could have learned all that working for Blake and still be with the other side and...
Oh...
Now, speaking of Wilson, how about getting him killed?
I tried to warn him, but there wasn't enough time. It was either go along with that or blow my cover and endanger the whole operation.
And when I wanted to give the plans to Blake, you objected.
Same problem if I went with you to Blake or you went to him after we had talked. My cover was blown.
And suppose I had given you the plans. How would that have changed the situation?
We would have had a phony copy that I would have delivered to Igor and everything would have been fine. And there's still time for me to do that. If you will just believe me and tell me where the plans are.
I'd like to believe you. I really would.
Please, where are they, Larry?
Get me to Blake.
It's too dangerous. Look, you see this?
Yeah, it's a hypodermic.
It's death. Igor sent me here with this to kill you. Now, do you believe me?
Wait a minute. If you don't kill me, and I guess you don't intend to, what will Igor and his friends think? Isn't your cover blown then anyway?
Could be, but if I come back with the plans and say that I got them out of you without having to kill you, there's a chance they'll believe me.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Well?
I'm thinking. Who are you?
One of the hospital guards, monsieur.
Oh.
Mademoiselle, you have been here some time. How is the patient?
Guard.
Yes, monsieur?
Call Colonel Blake at U.S. Military Intelligence. Tell him I've got to see him right away on a matter of the utmost urgency.
Colonel Blake?
Colonel Blake.
I would inform my superior.
Now, you don't have to inform anyone. Just call him.
Yes, monsieur. The major will be disappointed you have not followed instructions.
You are a fool. I would have had the information if you hadn't come in when you did.
I know what you were ordered to do.
What? What's this?
A moment of truth, I'm afraid, Larry.
Oh, I know how highly the major regards you, mademoiselle. But I also know what he thinks of me. Tonight will change that. Give me that syringe.
Here, right in your arm.
Oh, oh, you traitor. I knew.
Carol, you... You were telling me the truth.
Yes. Yes, I was. And I had to kill him. To make you see it. Where is the paper, please?
In my hotel room.
Oh, aren't you ever going to stop playing games? You know your room was searched.
Let me get dressed and I'll show you.
If it's not here, there's going to be the devil to pay.
Don't worry, it's here.
Now, I'm the one who has to be shown. Trained operatives from two special branches went over this room with everything except Geiger counters.
Okay, okay.
Where are we going?
The bathroom.
That was searched, too.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
Oh, we went through that cabinet.
Did you now? What do you see?
Towels, paper tissues, some of your toilet articles. We took your razor apart.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And what else?
A roll of toilet tissue, unopened.
And as the French say, mademoiselle, voila!
Oh.
And now we unroll this toilet tissue and keep unrolling it, and...
Oh, my God. Where did you learn to open a package and reseal it like that?
When I was a kid, I was the best clerk in Roscoe's shipping department.
Oh, thanks. It was nice knowing you. I really mean that, Larry.
Hey, wait a minute, wait a minute. Surely I've earned the right to buy you dinner.
I'd like to.
Well, you'd better, or I'll start doing some talking.
Blackmail?
You said it.
All right. I'll meet you at Les Deux Magots at 10:30.
No way. Let's try the right bank, La Rotonde.
That's a date. I'll see you.
You better be there.
Shirts, ties, yes, I think that's everything. Come. Oh, it's you, Rodzinski. Are you coming with me?
I am staying.
And we shall say goodbye. I do not have much time. The plane from Moscow leaves at...
I do not think you'll be taking the plane.
Are you insane? You know I've been recalled.
Not precisely.
What do you mean, not precisely?
Moscow feels you have bungled badly.
So, it's not the first time that an operation has been...
First, you were duped by the American girl. You know she was a double agent?
I know now. Did you know before she killed Leclerc?
I was not in charge at that time.
At that time?
Now there are two murders that cannot be hushed up. The French police must have a murderer to satisfy the public.
Then give them Carol. She...
I only wish that we could. They want you. You have been chosen to be the murderer. I am replacing you as the head of this section.
Ridiculous! I won't remain quiet. I have a lot I could and will say to the authorities if Moscow abandons me. Now you listen to me, Rodzinski.
I have no time to listen.
Rodzinski, wait! That hypodermic! Don't!
Oh. Igor, you should be pleased to know that your dying will serve a good cause.
Sorry, I'm late, but I...
But?
There were loose ends that had to be cleared up.
Well, I thought maybe you decided against coming.
Oh.
After all, your job here is finished.
Well, yes.
Sit down, sir. Now that the Russians know you, there's nothing for you to do. It would be suicide to try to, huh?
Oh, well, there are other things for me.
Sure. Like getting married to a lovesick newspaper man, settling down, raising a family.
Oh. Oh, I take it I'm your first Mata Hari.
Mm-hmm. First and only.
Well, Larry were very different from other women. In our business, you pay dues. And they're heavy payments.
I don't get it.
I'm talking about sitting at another cafe on the left bank. Sitting and knowing that an agent named Wilson was going to be killed. Clumsily trying to warn him, and finally deciding that his death was the way it had to be. Larry, that's a big payment.
But you can forget about it now. It wasn't your fault.
No, forget about that and forget about LeClaire.
Well, you had to...
You see, it's even hard for you to say. I had to kill him. No, Larry, I have to keep on to justify those things.
But, Carol, listen...
Bye, Larry. Thanks for the champagne.
But our dinner. I've ordered dinner. At least have dinner with me.
Oh, we both know what I have to do. If I ever change my mind, I promise I'll come running.
Larry Fielding sat in La Rotonde and watched her walk away. He knew she was walking out of his life. For a moment, he toyed with the idea of running after her and joining her world of spies. He flirted with the idea that he might even be some sort of an American James Bond. But then, the waiter brought the dinner. And to his surprise, he was hungry. Back in New York, Larry Fielding returned to his old job. An old friend and boss, Horace Finley, who was curious about what had happened in Paris. Finley kept pressing Larry to tell him about his Parisian adventure. Finally, Larry said, "I'll tell you, Horace. In Paris, the food was good." Our cast included William Redfield, Joan Loring, Roger DeCoven, Ian Martin, and Chris Gampel. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
Well, it's probably better anyway. You know, you really can't trust spies. I'll tell you who you can trust. You can trust the strange Dr. Weird to tell you an interesting story, if nothing else, which he did on April the 17th of 1945 with Dead Man's Paradise.
The Strange Dr. Weird.
Good evening. Come in, won't you? Well, what's the matter? You seem a bit nervous. Perhaps the cemetery outside this house has upset you. But there are things far worse than cemeteries. For instance, being lost in a wilderness. A wilderness where death is never more than a few inches away. As in the story I want to tell you tonight. A story I call Dead Man's Paradise. My story begins in the wild and desolate swamplands near the mouth of the Mississippi River. In a small Cajun shack, all but hidden by the overhanging cypress trees, André Morel speaks to his son, Paul.
Paul, the sun has been up for an hour already. You must see to our traps.
Yeah, but, Father, you're ill. I don't like leaving you here alone.
I'll be all right. Now, please, tend to the traps.
Very well, Father. I'll be back just as soon as I...
Take him out, Paul. Who are you? What do you want?
You'll find out soon enough, old man.
Duke, get that rifle of theirs over the fireplace.
Okay. Well, you must be the two bank robbers the radio was warning everyone about.
That's right, bright boy. Now every cop in Louisiana's looking for us. How far are we from New Orleans?
40 miles.
40 miles, huh? Well, you're taking us there in your boat.
But we lend our boat to Pierre Duvel. Besides, no boat can get through swamps.
Hey, Ace, what are we going to do? We figured on sailing right through to New Orleans with no trouble at all.
We'll have to make it on foot, that's all. These Cajuns know every inch of the swamp, so Bright Boy here will guide us.
No, no, it's impossible.
Well, you must. He will kill you if you do not do as he asks.
That's right, kid. Your old man's talking sense.
But you don't know the swamps. We must travel by narrow Indian trails through bad stretches of quicksand where a single misstep means death.
It can't be that bad. Why, on my road map, this region is listed as Paradise Swamp.
Yes, but the old name, the name the Indians gave it, was Dead Man's Paradise. Because no stranger who ever entered it came out alive. There's the quicksand, pools of it, waiting to trap strangers. And there are the insects, the mosquitoes that drive men mad. There are the birds, whose shrieks sound like the screams of dying men.
Hey, listen to that.
That's a lot of malarkey. Bright Boy here's going to guide us, and that's that.
But I can't leave my father here alone. Can't you see he's ill?
I don't want to leave him alone any more than you do. He might talk. So I'm going to see to it that none of us have to worry about him anymore.
What do you mean?
Just this.
Father! You've killed him.
Yeah, and that's what's going to happen to you if you don't do exactly as I tell you. Now let's get started. I want to be in New Orleans by tomorrow night.
We've been walking for 7 hours now, Ace. How far do you figure we've come?
Hey, Bright Boy, how far we come this morning?
10 miles.
10 miles? Hey, that ain't bad.
Hey, Ace, what's that?
That's just a bird, not a ghost. Pull yourself together, Duke. There's nothing to be scared of. Just trees, underbrush, and swamp pools.
Yeah, yeah, I know, but every way you turn, everything looks the same.
Yeah.
If we didn't have that Cajun kid to guide us. Hey, Ace, look, kid's trying to give us a slip.
Oh, he is he? Well, this'll teach him.
Ace, you hit him.
Yeah, I could hardly miss him at this distance. Come on. Should have kept a closer watch on him. Might have known he'd try something like this. Well, here he is.
Yeah, his head's all covered with blood. He's dead, all right.
Yeah. You never knew what hit him.
Yeah, but Ace, what are we going to do now without the kid to guide us?
Well, we'll just have to go on the rest of the way by ourselves.
But how we find our way every way you turn is nothing but swamp. We can't go on without a guide.
Get hold of yourself, you fool. If you lose your head, you're done for.
Yeah, but Ace, what chance we
got? Shut up, will you? Listen to what I have to say. By keeping our eyes on the sun and doing a little figuring, we can keep going in the right direction. As for the quicksand, well, we'll just have to watch our step. Just keep saying one thing to yourself. New Orleans is only 30 miles away, and we're going to make it.
5 hours have passed. 5 hours of nightmare for Ace and Duke. The shadowy cypress trees and underbrush seemed to become thicker every mile they pushed on. And they were constantly forced to detour around swamp pools and lakes, ever mindful of the treacherous quicksands they must avoid.
How far do you think we've come since we left that Cajun kid?
About 4 or 5 miles, I guess.
Hey, look, the sun's going down. It'll be dark before long. What do we do now?
We'll stop pretty soon and wait for dawn. In the morning, we'll push on.
Neither of you will ever get out of these boats alive.
Did you hear that?
Yeah, that sounded like...
You have committed murder, and you must pay.
Yes, it's the voice of that Cajun kid.
No, it can't be. I knocked him over.
It's the voice of his ghost, that's what it is.
But don't be a fool.
The ones who have died in the swamps, they, you too, must die.
Hey, you see, I told you he's come back to get us.
Both of you will die in the quicksand. Only 20 feet ahead of you is a pool of quicksand.
Hey, see, ahead, that's quicksand ahead.
Now, don't be a fool, I tell you. You really think this quicksand ahead he'd warn us? Just a trick to get us to walk in another direction where the quicksand really is.
I guess you're right.
Why, sure I am. Now keep going, straight ahead.
Okay.
We still got an hour or so until it gets too dark to travel. We got to make the most of it.
But just the same, don't you think? Hey!
What's wrong?
I stepped into some quicksand, Ace. Help me, I'm sinking.
Duke, try crawling out.
I can't, it keeps sinking deeper. Ace, help me.
If I only had a rope or something. Where did I look around?
No, it's only me.
Look, how can I help you?
Ace, suck me down. It's already up to my chest. Give me a hand and pull me out, will you?
I can't do that. You'd pull me in with you.
Why, do something.
There's nothing I can do without a rope.
No, there must be. Ace, don't let me fall like this. Help, will you?
There's only one thing I can do for you, Duke. And this is it. Duke, he's dead.
Yes, he's paid for his crime. Now it is your
No.
No, you may have gotten Duke, but you won't get me. You won't get me!
With an effort, Ace pulled himself together, determined not to suffer Duke's fate. Taking a bearing from the twilight rays of the sun, Ace continued on his way, cautiously scanning the ground before him. Time and time again, the voice of the Cajun boy came echoing through the swamps, mocking Ace's efforts to escape, telling him of the quicksand that lay waiting on every side.
There's no escape for you. Just ahead of you lies quicksand. And you are going to die in it.
Shut up! Shut up, you hear?
Death is waiting for you in the quicksand ahead.
Maybe this will keep you quiet.
You should have saved one bullet for yourself.
Be quiet. Be quiet, you hear? You're dead. You can't talk.
You seem confused now. Is the quicksand ahead of you? To the left? To the right? If I were you, I'd turn to the left.
Oh, trying to outsmart me, aren't you? Well, you can't. I'm going straight ahead.
You're making a mistake. There is quicksand just ahead.
If it was, you wouldn't be telling me. I know better than to be. I caught. It is quicksand. I'm sinking.
Yes. It's quicksand. And in a minute, you'll sink beneath the surface. And your crimes will be paid for.
You're not dead. You're alive. I didn't kill you.
No. That bullet you fired at me only creased my scalp. Knocked me unconscious. I recovered in time to trail you. Get my revenge.
Oh, don't stand there. Get me out of here. I'll confess to anything. Only get me out of here.
Why should I help you? You killed my father. No! This is the same pool of quicksand that Duke died in. And now you're going to join him.
No! No!
You've been wandering around in circles for hours. But I knew you'd end up here.
No, no. Oh, don't let me die. Don't let me die.
The quicksand is up to your neck now. In a minute, we'll reach your mouth. And then, it'll be all over.
Save me. I don't want to die.
No, my father didn't want to die either. But you killed him.
Help me. You must help me.
Nobody can help you now.
Don't let me go.
I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to tell you that this is the only quicksand hole in all the swamp between here and New Orleans.
If Ace had only known there was just one pool of quicksand, he might have reached New Orleans. But you see, he let his imagination run wild, envisioned death on all sides. No wonder he traveled in circles and ended up dead. I know another case where... Oh, you have to go now? Too bad. But perhaps you'll drop in on me again soon. I'm always home. Just look for the house on the other side of the cemetery. The house of Dr. Weir.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was the Dr. Weird show. The strange Dr. Weird. That voice may have sounded familiar. If you're used to listening to The Mysterious Traveler at all, Maurice Taupin played both the host here as the strange Dr. Weird and The Mysterious Traveler. The Mysterious Traveler was a good deal more successful and lasted a good deal longer. This was a very short-lived series, running only from November 7th of 1944 through May 15th of 1945. It lasted only 28 shows, and really probably didn't deserve a very much longer run than that. Still, It's fun in a sort of cheesy way, and its brevity does come in handy when trying to schedule this program, even if it does occasionally make this program sound like a cheese factory. We got a break, but we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. I said science fiction next, and I meant science fiction next. So in this connection, we have an episode of X-1 from July 17th of 1956, The Old Die Rich, based on a short story by Horace Lawrence Gold, better known to most of us who were reading science fiction at the time as H.L. Gold, editor of Galaxy Magazine from 1950 to 1961. It is as the editor of Galaxy Magazine that Horace Gold is best remembered and made his biggest impact in science fiction. It was under Horace Gold that science fiction sort of matured, or at least took a slightly different direction into a more sociological point of view. Became less concerned about the technology, the gee whiz, how does this stuff work, aspects of science fiction, and more concerned about how all of this affects people. Not to say that Horace Gold was not a reasonably prominent writer. He was. He published his first story in John Campbell's Astounding Magazine in 1934 using a pseudonym, Clyde Crane Campbell.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of a future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents X-1. Tonight, The Old Die Rich by H.L. Gold.
The uniformed cop at the door told me to get lost, but Lou Pape spotted me and told the man to let me in. It was a shabby room, they always are. There was a woman on the bed, an old woman with white hair, thin enough to show the tight-drawn scalp. The medical examiner was going over her as if she were a side of beef that you had to put a federal-grade stamp on.
When are you going to stop taking this ham friend of yours around to these cases, Sergeant, just to gratify his morbid curiosity?
Forget about Weldon, Doc. What did she die of?
Not eating, malnutrition.
Oh, now look, Doc, in the top bureau drawer, she had bank books showing $32,000 from five different banks. Now, she had the price of a meal.
Malnutrition induced by senile psychosis. They starve because they're less afraid of death than digging into their savings.
I don't know, Doc. It doesn't feel right to me.
Listen, Weldon, just because you get up on a stage or on some half-baked television show and make believe you're 70 years old doesn't qualify you as an expert on gerontology.
Maybe not, Doc. But I went bald at 25, and I've been playing old men ever since. There's a lot more to it than just shuffling around and talking in a high-cracked voice.
Yeah, there hasn't been an actor since Otis Skinner.
Maybe. But the way I work, I have to get inside the character. I have to decide when he was born, how he got along with his father, where he went to school, what he thinks of women, everything about a character.
There isn't a one of them these days can make themselves heard past the fifth row.
Look, I'm serious. Now, I've tried imagining myself growing weak from hunger. I've tried to think of not even spending a nickel to keep me from dying. I just don't believe it. It isn't right. I don't feel it.
Well, lucky for me, I don't have to feel these things inside of me because I'm a doctor and not an actor. Sergeant, malnutrition induced by senile psychosis. I'll order the wicker basket from Bellevue. So long, Barrymore.
Well, he's right, Mark. We get a couple of these cases every year. Some old bat starving to death with $17,000 in old bills pinned on his union suit. Time's up all the time.
Al, it doesn't feel right.
Well, he knows his business.
But he doesn't know old people. I do. It isn't easy to starve to death. Not when you can buy day-old bread at the bakery or wilted vegetables the grocer's ready to throw out. Anyone who's willing to eat that stuff can stay alive from day to day. Hunger's a... well, it's a pretty potent instinct.
Maybe they get too sick to go out after old bread or wilted vegetables.
It takes weeks to die of starvation. Did you ever try starving for weeks, Lou?
No, did you?
Well, the point is somebody would find out. A janitor, a landlord, somebody, and they'd get him to a hospital.
Ah, forget about it, Mark. Can't argue with it. Here there were five bank books, $32,000.
Yeah, she took good care of them. They look almost new.
Sure she did. Most important thing in the world, huh?
April 23rd, 1907, $150. The ink's pretty dark. Shouldn't it be faded?
She probably never took it out in the light.
Anyone ever think of testing the ink?
What for? Bank's records always check. These aren't forgeries, if that's what you're thinking.
Well, I'd like to get a chemist working on this ink.
Ah, now, Mark. Look, this is strictly against regulations. I got to take these books down to the squad room and sign them in.
Pretty dark ink for 1907.
Well, it's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I guess I could hold them over tonight and bring them down to the property clerk in the morning.
Good. I know where I can find a chemist.
Mr. Weldon, there's no doubt of it. The ink sample is typical of inks used 50 years ago. 1907 would be about right.
There, you see, Weldon? I was supposed to go to the Trotters tonight.
But according to the amount of oxidation, it's fresh enough to be only a few months old.
There, I was right.
Well, couldn't that be the result of unusually careful handling them?
Oh, yes, yes, I suppose it could. An airtight compartment, perhaps, sealed with one of the inert gases or a vacuum. That might account for the lack of normal aging.
Lou, you can't keep inert gases in a top bureau drawer in a fourth-floor walk-up.
Yeah. Well, it's probably some simple explanation.
For fresh ink... half a century old. I've been going out on these cases for about a year. It's my specialty playing old people, and when I'm not working television or something on Broadway, I go down to the homes for the aged or the parks or just watch. Lou Pape's an old friend of mine, and he put me on these malnutrition cases. But there was more to it than just picking up color and tricks of the trade. There had to be a better reason for it. You can't just starve to death with upwards of $30,000 right at your fingertips. Not without at least buying a bowl of soup. I had a run of television that kept me busy for about a month. Then Lou Pape called me up and asked me to come down to Bellevue.
I'll autopsy if you want it, Sergeant, but I can give you the cause of death right now. Malnutrition due to senile psychosis.
What's up, Lou?
Well, Mark, an old guy was found wandering around down on Hester Street. Suffering from malnutrition, he had $17,000 in cash inside the lining of his jacket.
Is he alive?
No, not now he isn't. Doc's got him in the room there, but he was stumbling around when the cop on the beat picked him up.
Did he say anything?
Well, he talked to the cop. Pretty smart young kid. Seems the old man kept talking about money and about his wife. She must have been dead 20 years. And then just before he went out completely, he did say something. Maybe 3 or 4 times.
Well, what was it?
El Greco.
You mean the artist?
Well, that's what Stankiewicz said. He's the officer who picked him up. Said he remembered he'd heard the name on that television quiz program. You know, the jockey who's the art expert.
El Greco.
Probably some Greek restaurant where he was bumming his meals. Now, you sure you want an autopsy, Sergeant? It's late. I won't get to it till tomorrow.
All right, take your time, Doc.
There's something else, isn't there, Lou?
Well, maybe, Mark. We found the old guy's room, and there was an ad thumbtacked over the sink. Nothing too unusual.
Yeah?
Here it is.
Men and women wanted, light work suitable for old people. No reference is required.
Well, I checked it with the lieutenant. He says to forget it. He says it figures for an old guy to be interested in an ad like that.
An old guy with $17,000 in cash?
Yeah. Well, I didn't figure I'd argue with the lieutenant.
You mind if I keep it?
No, go ahead.
It was an old brownstone house in the East 80s. I got in line with the rest of the applicants. My face was lined with collodion wrinkles, and I wore an antique shiny suit and run-down shoes. It was a good makeup job. I looked more authentic than the rest of the old-timers who were waiting for the interview. I finally came up to where a woman was asking the questions.
Name?
Kermit. Louis Kermit. Kermit.
Mm-hmm. Address?
Well, I don't exactly have a place. I've been staying with a fella down on 12th Street, a friend of mine. I met him in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm.
Previous occupation?
Well, I worked at a lot of things. Used to be a printer way back. I could handset.
Do you have any references?
Well...
Family?
No, ma'am. I haven't got any family. I had a cousin in Salt Lake City, but I haven't seen him in 30 years or more. The ad said you didn't need no references.
Well, that's right. Now, will you wait in the other room?
Yes, ma'am. Do I get the job, ma'am?
Just wait in the other room.
I shuffled into the other room and sat down to wait. I concentrated on building a character for Louis Kernet. If I was going to carry this through, I was going to have to play a better performance than I'd ever given before. About half an hour, a young woman came into the room. I'd planned to be dozing the way an old man would, and so my eyes were closed when I heard the door close. When I opened them, I was looking into the barrel of a .38 revolver.
Are you awake now, Mr. Weldon?
Huh? Ma'am?
I don't think you need to carry on anymore. If you need any further convincing, you are Mark Weldon. You're about 40 years old, and you played this same character on television about 6 weeks ago. You played it fairly well.
Thank you. Would you mind putting down that gun?
Yes. Why did you apply for this position, Mr. Weldon? You're not old, not really.
Well, as a matter of fact, it was a bet. I was having an argument about the method with an actor who trained at the Old Vic. I bet him that I could, I could get by off the stage.
Yeah, well, don't bother. You've been very busy recently trying to find out why senile psychotics starve themselves to death.
How did you know that?
Well, I happen to know that you've been present at several police investigations into these cases, and you're a good friend of Sergeant Lou Pape.
Well, you know a great deal more about me than I do about you.
Well, I would be glad to enlighten you. My name is May Roberts. I'm the daughter of the late Dr. Anthony Roberts, the physicist, who was dismissed from the Brookhaven Atomic Energy Laboratory 5 years ago.
I assume you're connected with these starvation cases, or you wouldn't have known I was investigating them.
Well, that's obvious, isn't it? I'm not afraid of professional detectives, Mr. Weldon. They deal only with facts. But I don't like amateurs. They guess too much. They don't stick to reality. Consequently, they're likely to get too close to the truth.
Unfortunately, Miss Roberts, I'm nowhere near the truth. I haven't the slightest idea how you're tied in with those starvation
deaths. Well, I intend to show you, Mr. Weldon. I'm happy to announce that you have the job.
Now, look,
Don't move, Mr. Weldon. Oh, incidentally, about 15 minutes ago, I called Sergeant Pape and told him I was your sister just in from Pittsburgh. I wanted to get in touch with you very badly, and Sergeant Pape was very sorry. He wished he could help me, but he didn't have the slightest idea where you were. All right, Mr. Weldon. Right ahead of you, please. Through that door.
She didn't look like the kind of girl who would get to hold the gun on me as I went down the hall. So that's all I did, just go down the hall. I climbed up to the fourth floor to a large room. There was a maze of electrical equipment bolted down, tubes and wires and dials. In the middle of the room was a wire mesh cage. She kept that gun on me steady as a rock. She began to set readings on the dials and flip switches on the control panel.
It'll take about 5 minutes for the field to build up, Mr. Weldon. Please get in the cathode area.
You mean that wire cage?
Go ahead.
All right.
Now, I wouldn't advise moving now, Mr. Weldon. The wire carries some 10,000 volts.
Now, look,
Mr. Weldon, you're curious. and you could turn out to be a great nuisance to me. As long as you've come this far, we might as well both benefit by it.
Benefit?
You'll find a suit of clothes on the floor there. Put it on.
But after all...
Put it on.
I didn't know whether she was bluffing about the electric charge, but the revolver looked real enough, so I stripped and changed into the other clothes. The shoes were a little too tight and pointed. The collar of the shirt was too stiffly starched and too high under my chin. The suit was too narrow at the shoulders and at the ankles. I remember my father had a suit like that. The same shiny blue serge.
All right. In your pocket, you'll find a set of envelopes. And you'll find a set of instructions on each. Follow them carefully.
I don't get it.
You will. Use the envelopes in the order they are arranged.
What's this all about?
Mr. Weldon, I meant it when I said this could be a benefit to both of us. There's no use explaining anything. You'll find out. And don't try to escape. It can't be done. All right. Now the field generators are ready.
Look, Miss Roberts, this is absolutely...
Just follow instructions, Mr. Weldon.
I blinked. I was standing outside a bank on a sunny day in spring. I stared at the people passing by. They were dressed like the characters in a 1930 movie. The women wore long dresses and flower pot hats. Men had hard straw hats, suits with narrow shoulders. Cars were square with flat radiators in the front. There was a trolley car passing by, and suddenly I realized that the last trolley car stopped running in Manhattan years ago. I tried to figure it out. It was New York, all right. I recognized some of the buildings. First, I figured it must have been hypnosis. And then I looked at the first of the envelopes in my pocket. I read it and walked into the bank.
Yes, sir. Our Mr. Golden tells me that you wish to open an account.
Yes, that's right.
Uh-huh. Well, we're very happy to have a new depositor. Very happy indeed. Of course, you realize the institution is in sound condition, very sound. You needn't worry about all those rumors in this bank. No, sir. Solid, solid.
Well, that's good.
All right, now then, name? Mark Weldon. You have no address in the city at present?
No.
And you're depositing $150.
That's right.
All righty. I'll just check the slip here. $150, right. And the date, May 15th, of course, 1931.
31? The Depression.
Oh, now, Mr. Weldon, this is a very good year for business. This temporary recession is bound to abate. Sound banking policies will see us through. It's just around the corner, you know.
What is?
Prosperity. All right, Mr. Weldon, we're very happy to have your account.
I went outside the bank and I stood there in the spring sunlight and let the terror soak into me. The possibility of the entire situation was gnawing at the edges of my mind. And then suddenly I wasn't there. It was as fast as blinking. I was outside another bank in the same city. The date on the next envelope was May 29th, and it was still 1931. I made a $75 deposit there and then $100 at another place a few days later, spending a few minutes each time and going ahead anywhere from a couple of days to almost a month. In 1934, I found myself inside a broker's office.
Very well, Mr. Weldon. As I understand it, you are buying this stock for a Dr. Anthony Roberts. Hmm?
That's right.
I assume the stock will be in his name?
That's right. I'm just acting as agent. I follow instructions.
Of course. Well, are you sure I can't convince you that you're making a big mistake?
No. These are my instructions.
Well, now, Mr. Weldon, we are a reputable brokerage house, and, well, frankly, I feel quite shaky about putting our clients' money into this kind of security. There's no future in it. It's a rare metal for which there's very little use for industrial purposes, and... However, if your client is adamant...
I have my instructions.
Very well, then. In the name of Dr. Anthony Roberts, 100 shares of Montana Uranium. Most unwise.
It went that way about 50-50. I'd deposit money in my own name in various banks at other times. Then I'd buy a stock or make a bet for May Roberts... On June 21st, 1932, I bet Jack Sharkey to take the heavyweight title away from Max Schmeling. There was Singing Wood in 1933 at Belmont Park and Max Bayer over Prime O'Connor. I went on skipping through the years, touching here and there for a few minutes to an hour at a time. It was in early October 1938, about 5 hours after I'd left May Roberts' house, before I realized what she had me doing. I was making deposits and winning sure bets, just as those senile psychotics had done. The ink on their bank book seemed fresh because it was fresh. It wasn't given a chance to oxidize. The rate I was going, I'd be back at my own time in a few hours with $15,000 compound interest in cash. But those old people had died of starvation somehow with all that cash in banks. I didn't know how it happened or why. But suddenly it occurred to me that I didn't want to be found dead in my hotel room. So rather than make the deposit in 1938, I grabbed a cab and told the driver to step on it. I got a mile away from the bank, and then the cab suddenly disappeared. I found myself in front of a counter at a lunchroom. The envelope instructed me to make a bet on the World Series. There wasn't any way to get out of the range of the machine. It picked me up at least 5 miles away from where I was supposed to be. Came back a week later to get my winnings. Was hungry, so I got myself a hamburger and went out the door. When I hit the sidewalk, it happened again.
Don't touch the cage yet, Mr. Weldon. I'll have to clear the charge.
Hey, what happened to my hamburger?
What?
The hamburger. I had it here. It's gone. I'm hungry.
I'll get you something to eat, Mr. Weldon, before your next trip. Well, you've done pretty well for yourself, haven't you?
Yes, I have. About 15,000. I had ketchup on my sleeve. It's gone.
Mr. Weldon, I want to talk seriously with you. Now you've seen part of what I'm doing.
Part?
My father was discharged from all his research and university connections because he insisted in publishing his findings on the temporal field research. All the conventional physicists explained that it was overwork and recommended everything from hot bouillon before retiring to psychoanalysis. Well, possibly both of these might have been beneficial. But the fact of the matter is that temporal field activities are quite true, and you've seen proof.
Well, I suppose I have.
So it seemed just a question of money, although obviously I can get all I need now.
But sending people back through time to bet on sure things like uranium...
It's a fair exchange. I pay well for service, don't I?
I suppose so.
But that isn't the most important thing. I've been able to save things that would have been lost otherwise. I've sent people back to find precious treasures that would have been destroyed or would have disappeared.
Like an El Greco painting?
Yes. And the original score of Mozart's Magic Flute that would have been burned in 1942, and a Picasso miniature that would have been lost at sea in 52. I have them all here.
Stolen?
No. Bought with money from the year itself at a fair price. Well, Mr. Weldon, I sent you back because I've needed someone to work with me on a regular basis. Someone who's faster and more alert than the old people I've hired till now.
Why old people?
It's a function of the field. You can't send somebody back to a year in which they didn't exist at all.
I'm hungry.
Please, Mr. Weldon, this is very important. My father died trying to prove the validity of his field theory to conventional scientists. And I don't intend to bother. We can become the most powerful people in the world.
I don't feel very powerful now. You haven't got a sandwich hanging around.
I want to make you an offer, Mr. Weldon. I need someone to help me expand the operation, plan the projects and research. I chose you because I was afraid that you might hit on the truth by yourself.
Can I come out of this cage?
Be careful.
Now?
Don't touch the contacts. The field reacts on a random factor for at least an hour after it's cut off.
I'll be careful. Tell me, Miss Roberts, why haven't you been able to go back to the time that your father was alive and bring him back before he died?
Dead tissue can't be transported. We've tried it with mice and rabbits from a laboratory in 1941, and they just disappear.
Like my hamburger.
Mr. Weldon, I assume that you're interested, and that we can make our plans without using this revolver.
I hope so. $15,000 is a lot of money. Of course, you were able to send those old people back a lot further.
Some of them as far back as 1880.
How long would they be gone? I mean, in subjective time.
Several weeks. Perhaps a month or more.
There's only one problem, Miss Roberts.
Well, I'm sure we can work out any details.
Well, this one is a little hard to work out. You see, I'm hungry. I haven't been this hungry since I got lost on a hunting trip and went without food for 3 days. You see, you forget I've got an interest in this business because they found some old people dead of malnutrition and $30,000 or so tucked away in their pockets. They had been gone a month or more, and they had to eat during that time, didn't they? When they came back, the food disappeared like my hamburger. It disappeared all at once, all over their body. In one fast jolt, they starved to death.
No, no, you don't understand. They just couldn't take the field transition. They were too old, some of them, and they lied to me about their age to get the job.
Oh, no, you can't tell me that because I know how hungry I am. And I was only gone about 12 hours. They were murdered.
Get back.
You know, they say a hungry man gets mighty desperate. He'll do almost anything.
Let go of it. Oh! My arm.
Look out. Look out. The cage. The contact. She fell into that cage and disappeared before she hit the ground. I didn't know what happened. I know she said the field worked in a random factor, whatever that meant. I called Lou Pate and he came to the house just after the fire started. Something went in the control panel and it turned out to be a four-alarm fire before they got it under control. There was nothing left of the machine. There wasn't much left of the brownstone house. Lou didn't believe the story I told him.
You mean there won't be any more of them? No more senile psychotics starving to death with a bankroll in their hip pocket?
No, I told you, Lou.
Come on now, Mark. We'll get plenty more. We always have.
No, I'll bet you won't. I'll bet you a dollar there won't be another case like that.
I'll take that bet.
I lost the bet. There was one more case. And perhaps it was the strangest one. A woman was found wandering in Bryant Park just before she died of acute starvation. One strange thing was she was young, not more than 30. And the other was she had $17,000 stuffed in her pocketbook and a bullet wound in her arm the medical examiner said was at least 2 months old. I guess that's what she meant by the random factor. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought to you The Old Die Rich, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by H.L. Gold and adapted for radio by Ernest Kenoy. Featured in the cast were Jim Bowles, Jan Miner, Bill Zuckert, Guy Repp, Wendell Holmes, Ralph Camargo, and Ivor Francis. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Bob Maurer and is an NBC Radio Network production.
The little bus clattered to a stop in front of the sheriff's office of Martinville, and two weary and angry men climbed out. A moment later, they were confronting Sheriff Patrick O'Brien. Luke Barlow, the bus driver, was really perturbed.
Sheriff, I got held up again today on the road to Rawhide. The robber was wearing a mask, so I couldn't identify him.
The sheriff jerked a thumb at the little man standing near his desk.
Well, no wonder you got held up carrying John Friday along with you. And what was you doing, Mr. Friday? Going for a joyride?
Oh, no, Patrick. I was going to Rawhide on business. The culprit robbed me of $5.13, too. And then he waded up the creek to get away. I guess he didn't want to leave any trail.
Oh, didn't he know?
Patrick, if you'll listen to me, I think I know how we can find the guilty man.
Well, I don't know why I should listen to you, but I'll do it. And your plan had better be a good one, too.
That night, John Friday left his hotel and headed for the Silver Dollar Bar. In the gloom outside the swinging doors lay the body of Sheriff O'Brien. There was terror in his voice as he rushed into the crowded bar.
Man, come help me. The sheriff's been hurt.
Luke Barlow and a couple of cowboys rushed to carry the officer inside. The front of the man's shirt was covered with blood, and his inert body dangled as the men carried him to a cot in the back room. John Friday, as deputy of Martin County, took over the situation. He climbed onto a table and addressed the men.
Men, now I have a hunch that one of you killed Sheriff O'Brien, so I'm going to have to hold you all until I make a search for the murder knife. Line up against the bar. But Luke, you hold this gun on them while I make the search.
None of the men objected to being searched, and no knives were found except short-bladed pocket knives, and they had no bloodstains. John Friday faced the line of men again.
All right, boys. Take off your boots. We'll look into them.
Standing first on one foot and then the other, the men pulled off their boots, and John plunged a searching hand into each one. One man seemed to have trouble with his boots, but at last he managed to get them off. John reached into a boot, then looked at the socks the miner was wearing. He jerked erect and called to Luke Barlow.
Keep this man covered, Luke.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've made it. Well, made it to the last break anyway. But I can promise this really is the last break.
Keep this man covered, Luke. He's the one that robbed us at the creek.
The miner snarled at the little man.
You're talking through your hat.
Oh, no, you're wrong. I'm talking through wet socks that you didn't take time to change after you held up the bus and waded the creek to get away.
The miner's hand snatched at the holster at his side. A shot rang out, but not from the robber's gun. All eyes turned toward the door that led into the back room. There stood Sheriff Patrick O'Brien, very much alive. Then he turned to his deputy.
Well, John Friday, it looks like your hunch of making me play dead while you look for a pair of wet socks got us a payroll robber, doesn't it? It sure does, Patrick. Ain't you glad?
This is Pat McGinn in Hollywood, California, saying goodbye from my writer, Charles Crowder, and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
We're going to finish up with a short story from the LibriVox. This time it's a little Robert Sheckley. One of his very earliest short stories, called The Hour of the Battle, which was originally published in Space Science Fiction for September of 1953.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Megan Argo. The Hour of Battle by Robert Sheckley. As one of the Guardian ships protecting Earth, the crew had a problem to solve. Just how do you protect a race from an enemy who can take over a man's mind without seeming effort or warning? That hand didn't move, did it? Edwardson asked, standing at the port, looking at the stars. No, Morse said. He had been staring fixedly at the Attison detector for over an hour. Now he blinked three times rapidly and looked again. Not a millimetre. I don't think it moved either, Castle added from behind the gunfire panel, and that was that. The slender black hand of the indicator rested unwaveringly on zero. The ship's guns were ready, their black mouths open to the stars. A steady hum filled the room. It came from the Attison detector, and the sound was reassuring. It reinforced the fact that the detector was attached to all the other detectors, forming a giant network around Earth. "Why in hell don't they come?" Edwardson asked, still looking at the stars. "Why don't they hit?" "Ah, shut up," Morse said. He had a tired, glum look. High on his right temple was an old radiation burn, a sunburst of pink scar tissue. From a distance it looked like a decoration. "I just wish they'd come," Edwardson said. He returned from the port to his chair, bending to clear the low metal ceiling. "Don't you wish they'd come?" Edwardson had the narrow, timid face of a mouse, but a highly intelligent mouse, one that cats did well to avoid. "Don't you?" he repeated. The other men didn't answer. They had settled back to their dreams, staring hypnotically at the detector face. "They've had enough time," Edwardson said, half to himself. Castle yawned and licked his lips. "Anyone want to play some gin?" he asked, stroking his beard. The beard was a memento of his undergraduate days. Castle maintained he could store almost 15 minutes' worth of oxygen in its follicles, although he had never stepped into space unhelmeted to prove it. Morse looked away, and Edwardson automatically watched the indicator. This routine had been drilled into them, branded into their subconscious. They would as soon have cut their throats as leave the indicator unguarded. "Do you think they'll come soon?" Edwardson asked, his brown rodent's eyes on the indicator. The men didn't answer him. After 2 months together in space, their conversational powers were exhausted. They weren't interested in Castle's undergraduate days, or in Morse's conquests. They were bored to death even with their own thoughts and dreams, bored with the attack they expected momentarily. "Just one thing I'd like to know," Edwardson said, slipping with ease into an old conversational gambit. "How far can they do it?" They had talked for weeks about the enemy's telepathic range, but they always returned to it. As professional soldiers, they couldn't help but speculate on the enemy and his weapons. It was their shop talk. "Well," Morse said wearily, "our detector network covers the system out beyond Mars's orbit." "Where we sit," Castle said, watching the indicators now that the others were talking. "They might not even know we have a detection unit working," Morse said, as he had said 1,000 times. "Oh, stop," Edwardson said, his thin face twisted in scorn. "They're telepathic. They must have read every bit of stuff in Everset's mind." "Everset didn't know we had a detection unit," Morse said, his eyes returning to the dial. "He was captured before we had it." "Look," Edwardson said. "They ask him, 'Boy, what would you do if you knew a telepathic race was coming to take over the Earth? How would you guard the planet?'" "Idle speculation," Castle said. "Maybe Everset didn't think of this." "He thinks like a man, doesn't he? Everyone agreed on this defense. Everset would too." "Syllogistic," Castle murmured, very shaky. "I sure wish he hadn't been captured," Edwardson said. "It could have been worse," Morse put in, his face sadder than ever. "What if they captured both of them?" "I wish they'd come," Edwardson said. Richard Everset and C.R. Jones had gone on the first interstellar flight. They had found an inhabited planet in the region of Vega. The rest was standard procedure. A flip of the coin had decided it. Everset went down in the scouter, maintaining radio contact with Jones in the ship. The recording of that contact was preserved for all Earth to hear. "Just met the natives," Everset said. "Funny looking bunch. Give you the physical description later." "Are they trying to talk to you?" Jones asked, guiding the ship in a slow spiral over the planet. "No. Hold it." "Well, I'm damned! They're telepathic. How do you like that?" "Great," Jones said. "Go on." "Hold it. Say, Jonesy, I don't know as I like these boys. They haven't got nice minds." "Brother!" "What is it?" Jones asked, lifting the ship a little higher. "Minds! These bastards are power crazy. Seems they've hit all the systems around here, looking for someone to..."
"Yeah?"
"I've got that a bit wrong," Everset said, pleasantly. "They're not so bad." Jones had a quick mind, a suspicious nature, and good reflexes. He set the accelerator for all the G's he could take, lay down on the floor, and said, "Tell me more." "Come on down," Everset said, in violation of every law of spaceflight. "These guys are all right. As a matter of fact, they're the most marvellous..." That was where the recording ended, because Jones was pinned to the floor by 20 G's of acceleration as he boosted the ship to the level needed for the sea jump. He broke 3 ribs getting home, but he got there. A telepathic species was on the march. What was Earth going to do about it? A lot of speculation necessarily clothed the bare bones of Jones's information. Evidently, the species could take over a mind with ease. With Everset, it seemed that they had insinuated their thoughts into his, delicately altering his previous convictions. They had possessed him with remarkable ease. How about Jones? Why hadn't they taken him? Was distance a factor? Or hadn't they been prepared for the suddenness of his departure? One thing was certain. Everything Eversat knew, the enemy knew. That meant that they knew where Earth was, and how defenseless the planet was to their form of attack. It could be expected that they were on their way. Something was needed to nullify their tremendous advantage, but what sort of something? What armor is there against thought? How do you dodge a wavelength? Pouch-eyed scientists gravely consulted their periodic tables. And how do you know when a man has been possessed? Although the enemy was clumsy with Eversat, would they continue to be clumsy? Wouldn't they learn? Psychologists tore their hair and bewailed the absence of an absolute scale for humanity. Of course, something had to be done at once. The answer, from a technological planet, was a technological one. Build a space fleet and equip it with some sort of detection network. This was done in record time. The Attison detector was developed, a cross between radar and the electroencephalograph. Any alteration from the typical human brainwave pattern of the occupants of a detector-equipped ship would boost the indicator around the dial. Even a bad dream or a case of indigestion would jar it. It seemed probable that any attempt to take over a human mind would disturb something. There had to be a point of interaction somewhere. That was what the Attison detector was supposed to detect. Maybe it would. The spaceships, three men to a ship, dotted space between Earth and Mars, forming a gigantic sphere with Earth in the centre. Tens of thousands of men crouched behind gunfire panels, watching the dials on the Attison detector. The unmoving dials.
"Do you think I could fire a couple of bursts?"
Edwardson asked, his fingers on the gunfire button.
"Just to limber the guns."
"Those guns don't need limbering," Castle said, stroking his beard. "Besides, you'd throw the whole fleet into a panic." "Castle," Morse said very quietly, "get your hand off your beard."
"Why should I?"
Castle asked. "Because," Morse answered, almost in a whisper, "I am about to ram it right down your fat throat." Castle grinned and tightened his fists.
"Pleasure,"
he said.
"I'm tired of looking at that scar of yours."
He stood up.
"Cut it,"
Edwardson said wearily.
"Watch the birdie."
"No reason to, really," Morse said, leaning back. "There's an alarm bell attached." But he still looked at the dial.
"What if the bell doesn't work?" Edwardson asked. "What if the dial is jammed? How would you like something cold slithering into your mind?"
"The dial will work," Castle said. His eyes shifted from Edwardson's face to the motionless indicator.
"Oh, I think I'll sack in," Edwardson said.
"Stick around," Castle said. "Play you some gin."
"All right."
Edwardson found and shuffled the greasy cards, while Morse took a turn glaring at the dial.
"I sure wish they'd come," he said.
"Cut,"
Edwardson said, handing the pack to Castle.
"I wonder what our friends look like," Morse said, watching the dial.
"Probably remarkably like us,"
Edwardson said, dealing the cards. Castle picked them up one by one, slowly, as if he hoped something interesting would be under them.
"They should have given us another man," Castle said. "We could play bridge."
"I don't play bridge," Edwardson said.
"You could learn."
"Why didn't we send a task force?"
Morse asked.
"Why didn't we bomb their planet?"
"Don't be dumb," Edwardson said. "We'd lose any ship we sent, probably getting them back at us, possessed and firing."
"Knock with 9, Castle said.
"I don't give a good damn if you're not with 1,000, Edwardson said gaily. "How much do I owe you now?"
$3,508,010.
"I sure wish they'd come," Morse said.
"Want me to write a check?"
"Take your time. Take until next week."
"Someone should reason with the bastards," Morse said, looking out the port. Castle immediately looked at the dial.
"I just thought of something," Edwardson said.
"Yeah?"
I bet it feels horrible to have your mind grabbed, Edwardson said. I bet it's awful. You'll know when it happens, Castle said. Did Everset?
Probably. He just couldn't do anything about it.
My mind feels fine, Castle said. But the first one of you guys starts acting queer, watch out. They all laughed. Well, Edwardson said, I'd sure like a chance to reason with them. This is stupid. Why not? Castle asked. What, you mean go out and meet them? Sure, Castle said. We're doing no good sitting here. I should think we could do something, Edwardson said slowly. After all, they're not invincible. They're reasoning beings. Morse punched a course on the ship's tape, then looked up. You think we should contact the command? Tell them what we're doing?
No,
Castle said, and Edwardson nodded in agreement.
Red tape. We'll just go out and see what we can do. If they won't talk, we'll blast them out of space.
Look! Out of the port, they could see the red flare of a reaction engine, the next ship in their sector, speeding forward.
They must have got the same idea, Edwardson said. Let's get there first, Castle said.
Morse shoved the accelerator in, and they were thrown back in their seats.
That dial hasn't moved yet, has it?
Edwardson asked, over the clamour of the detector alarm bell.
Not to move out of it, Castle said,
looking at the dial with its indicator slammed all the way over to the highest notch. End of The Hour of Battle by Robert Sheckley. Read by Megan Argo.
Well, I guess we've come to the end of the so-called dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions, and we're going to fade off here into music. But before I do that, I want to remind everybody that you can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You know, it's not like I know what I'm doing here, so if you have any suggestions or you just want to tell me where to go, feel free. If you have an old radio show that you remember that's in this vein that we do here, tell me about it. I'll see if I can find it and play it. I'd also like to encourage you to visit the website, which is where the show notes are kept. The website, not surprisingly, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions is one word, no space or underscore or anything between the night and the transmission. Just Night Transmissions. Okay, well, I'm going to shut up now.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here, right by my side, and in her right hand, a silver dagger. She says that I can't be your bride. All men are false, says my mother. They'll tell you wicked love and lies. The very next evening they'll court another, leave you alone to pine and sigh. Daddy is a handsome devil. He's got a chain 5 miles long. In
on every link, a heart does dangle of another maid he's loved and wronged. Go court another tender maiden and hope that she will be your wife, for I've been I've decided to sleep alone all of my
in the house of the rising sun.